Good morning. I'm going to talk about capillary wave turbulence, which is a little bit outside the scope of this week's focus. It was rescheduled from last week anyway. The work was done at the Australian National University in Canberra, this is my group. Dr. Hua Xia was here before, a couple of weeks, 3 weeks. Myself, Dr. Hospansman, we're doing various things, turbulence in fluid layers, air surface waves, or nonlinear surface waves, and wave turbulence. Recently, we decided to add the rotation to our systems, and in the past, we were active in studying plasma turbulence in magnetically confined plasma. The topic I'm going to cover today can be found in more details in these three papers we have recently published, and the one of the motivations I'll explain later. So we study capillary waves. Capillary waves are small waves, less than 10 millimeter wavelength. The big advantage, you can study them basically on the tabletop type experiments, and you can excite them in different, in a variety of different ways. We usually use either the plunger, it's a point source, and waves propagate. Capillary waves don't propagate too far away because they're heavily damped. Another way is the parametric excitation on the in the vertically oscillating containers or on, placed upon the electrodynamic shaker. One of them shown here, it's a fairly powerful shaker, 4 kilonewton, which allows us to accelerate these containers at the frequencies up to several kilohertz. Or at low frequencies, we can accelerate the mass of about 100 kilos. That's the facility here. Basically, you see the container is somewhere here, camera, laser optics, this is the shaker, and it's all fairly small and handy. How we excite waves using parametric excitation is well known. By shaking the container, you can excite so-called Faraday waves, and the excitation of the Faraday waves can be viewed as a degenerate process. Thank you. As a degenerate process of the three-wave interactions, where we shake the container at the frequency omega naught, and two waves are excited at the frequency omega 1 and omega 2, but because the container is shaken as a whole, so the excitation K is zero, so we excite two waves, K1 and K2, which are the same in the absolute value, but they're oppositely directed, such that the dominant excited wave appears to be the first subharmonic of the excitation frequency. So this is the spectrum at the very low excitation level. We shake the container at the frequency of 50 hertz, and the strongest harmonic that is excited, and that's the one that we observe in the photo, is 25 hertz. Surface waves are subdivided into two main classes, as you know, the gravity waves and the capillary waves, depending on the nature of the returning force for the perturbation. Gravity waves are more, it's the dominant in the ocean. These are large waves from about 80 meters down to about 20 millimeters. And at below 10 millimeters, their surface tension becomes the dominant returning force. And this term becomes dominant for in the dispersion for capillary waves, in which the omega is proportional to K wave number to the power of 3/2. How we characterize those waves, depending on the amplitude and the steepness of the wave, we employ different techniques. For the lowest amplitudes, it is very useful to use laser reflection. We focus a laser beam on the surface of the water, and the reflected signal appears to be proportional to the slope of the surface elevation. Oh yeah, thank you, that's better. proportional to the slope of the surface elevation. However, the disadvantage of this method, if waves are too steep, the wave becomes reflected altogether and never gets onto the diffusive screen, and we never monitor this wave event. For really steep and really strong waves, we use just direct imaging of their surface by adding a small amount of the fluorescent dye into the water, like rhodamine B in this case, and illuminate the interface using a thin laser sheet. In this case, rhodamine fluoresces in the yellow-orange light when illuminated by the green laser sheet, and if we discriminate from the direct reflection of the green in front of the camera, we can monitor using fast cameras the surface interface. And the last technique, which we use in the intermediate range of the wave amplitudes, is the laser transmission through diffusive liquid. In this case, we have to add some diffusive particles into the water. Could be just suspended imaging particles, or skim milk works just fine. Small amount of skim milk diffuses a lot of light. The biggest advantage of this method is that in this case the modulation in the transmitted laser intensity becomes proportional to the surface elevation rather than to the slope. Okay, so I start with what was the main motivation for all these experiments, and there were plenty of experiments on the surface waves in the capillary range. Quite often the capillary wave turbulence is claimed to be the ultimate proof of the weak turbulence theory. And when we started looking into this problem and comparing the spectra, as everyone else did, we asked several questions which were not 100% clear to us. Firstly, the weak turbulence theory makes several assumptions, not just three, but the most important, perhaps, from our perspective, were as follows. First, capillary wave dispersion relation, this is a common statement you read everywhere, allows three-wave interactions. So this dispersion relation allows simultaneous satisfaction of these matching rules for the wave triads for omega and k. In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. And in the majority of the situations when we start our experiments, this relation isn't satisfied. I'll make a comment later. Second assumption, the waves have random phases. All the waves participating in the wave-wave interaction process should have random phases, almost random phases. The third one is the assumption of the infinite domain, which, of course, for the container size of what typically used in these experiments, 20, 30 centimeters, may be questioned. The prediction of the wave turbulence theory for capillary waves, usually experimental tests quite often limited to testing the shape of the spectrum. It should be a power law in the frequency domain, and the spectral power should be proportional to omega to the power minus 17 over 6, and P here is the energy flux. In the spectrum, it's built in the same model in mind as the Kolmogorov theory of the cascade. And basically, this is the largely the only dependence which is checked in experiments. This one, sometimes. Okay, a few examples of what experimentalists usually check. Trying to find the power law in the experimentally excited spectra of capillary waves, and while one may remain skeptical about this feats to the power law, in some other experiments, when the excitation is shifted towards very low frequencies, like for example in this experiment, I believe this is not what this is in mercury, and waves are generated using a wave maker, and the wave maker is randomized such that waves are the forcing is spread in the frequency range between 0 and 4 hertz. We observe decent power law. Power laws. This one corresponds to gravity range, and this corresponds to capillary range, and this scaling actually is not too bad. It's in pretty good agreement with the weak turbulence theory. However, even in this experiment, the square root dependence on the energy flux wasn't found. It was linear scaling. Well, again, typically what we observe when we just start shaking the container, we observe the generation of multiple harmonics. The energy is injected here, at the usually second harmonic, and the strongest harmonic is the first subharmonic, parametric excitation. And then everyone observes multiple frequency harmonics in this regime. If we shake harder, we see more harmonics, and they extend of up to several kilohertz sometimes. So we questioning the first assumption for such a spectra, that capillary wave dispersion relation allows three wave interactions. You just need a calculator to see that for a 1D wave field, this cannot be satisfied with this dispersion relation. For 2D field, it can be, but it's extremely restrictive. Was realized long time ago, back in 1966, I found one reference. As far as I remember, Lena did a more recent examination of this. It was published, I read it on the archive. Yeah. Anyway, for the vectors, the restrictions, the K1 and K2 should be in the range between, say, 75 to 83 degrees, which is not the case here. There is no three waves you can find in this spectrum, or even in this spectrum, which would obey this.
Why? You mean they all are like plane waves?
They're not plane waves, but you won't find any waves which would satisfy this.
So it's not isotropic excitation?
No. If you have broadband turbulence already, sure, you can find wave triads which will...
But those peaks, this in omega, but in K-space, what do they correspond to?
Look, it's a for rather simple mathematical exercise which has been done. I don't want to go.
No, I'm not asking that. I did it myself. I was given experimental data.
Yeah.
So when you excite parametrically, what wave numbers are excited? What for the system?
According to this dispersion relation, we have checked this dispersion relation.
Is violated. The direction of wave number is.
The direction is different, but you won't find precisely wave numbers K1 and K2 in this rather narrow range, unless you have substantially broadened the excitation. If you have a continuum, then fine. But if you don't have any continuum here, you won't find any wave triads. That's all I'm saying.
Approvally was distracted. When you measure K, how do you measure K?
Oh, we can measure K, yeah. We don't normally measure K. K can be measured just from the waveform if we visualize.
What's the aspect ratio of these experiments? They're not that high.
I'll cover that.
So just what about boundaries?
The typical we have 40, 50 wavelengths per the radius. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. It can be proven analytically that this system of equations have no solutions. So no exact solution. So I did it many years ago.
Okay.
And here we can just compute that in order these resonance conditions are satisfied, the directions of the vectors are very different. They are not linear. They have angle between two.
So what precludes your waves to have this angle? I mean, if they are
if you have a big choice, Grisha, if you have a big choice and broadband turbulence, nothing, it will work. I'll show this.
Okay.
But my question is not whether it exists in principle. My question is whether we can plausibly explain the transition from this spectrum or from this spectrum to the broadband spectrum and say that it's the same three-wave interaction process which is then at work in the weak turbulence theory.
Okay,
and
so
I question that.
From the Faraday system, you want to go to fully developed capillary turbulence and say, how can we get from one to the other?
It doesn't matter whether it's Faraday. This spectrum is universally observed for any monochromatic excitation, whether it's a wave breaker, whether it's a plunger, whether it's a shaker.
Doesn't matter.
The spectrum is precisely the same. And the question is how you move from the discrete spectrum to the continuum.
Okay.
Okay, so second assumption, random wave phases. Oh, thin peaks in this spectrum suggest that we are not talking about precisely random phases. Most likely they are coherent, and we computed their by coherence, which is a measure of the wave phase coupling in the three-wave interactions, normalized by the powers of corresponding frequencies f, f1, and f2, and f, f1, f2 satisfy f equals f1 plus f2. And we see that the degree of coherence in this wave field, in this spectrum, is quite high. It's above 0.5, which suggests we deal with really coherent waves, so no random phases so far. However, when we get to the broadband spectrum later on at very high levels of forcing, yes, we obtain the broadband spectrum, and the degree of the bicoherence drops to down below less than 0.2. So we do have this. So the question is how this transition occurs from the lowish, it's not the lowest, it's lowish forcing to strong forcing, and the transition from the discrete spectrum to the continuum spectrum. Okay, first observation is that at very low level of forcing, when we observe up to 7-8 harmonics, the amplitudes pretty nicely obey their exponential law, which immediately triggers the idea of the geometric progression rather than the cascade. However, at the highest excitation level, and by the highest I mean we prefer to stay below, just below their droplet formation limit, because otherwise we our optics becomes wet and many other effects come into play. We have a decent F minus 2.8 power law, which is not far away from 17 over 6. This is a pre-multiplied spectrum, which extends, well, almost over two decades in spectrum. But it's also useful to look at what's going on in the intermediate level of forcing, and in this case we have a combination of the two. We have the spectral harmonics are broadened now, and you see a substantial broadening, so we have to integrate over this band, and we put their spectral power here as an integral for each of the bands around.
Between the minima.
This band, etc. Yeah. And then we recover again precisely the same scaling here, and we have power law something close to 2 minus 2.8 in the tail. You see the harmonics continue, but we already have a transition. So the two trends intersect at what we call the crossover frequency, and I'll talk about this crossover frequency and its origin later. So far, I used the same trick as everyone else in this field. I didn't show you the whole spectrum. This is 10 hertz, and this is 10 hertz, and there is no reason why people cannot show starting from 1 hertz or 0.1 hertz or anything else. And it's quite important, a spectral feature which is hiding there, and this what we called zero frequency sideband. You see that if I extend my spectrum to 0.1, even at the lowest forcing, I already observe something. As the forcing goes up, this zero frequency sideband goes up in amplitude, and it extends in the frequency, and so on.
But this is already gravity waves, they aren't capillary.
Yeah, but this is something in that range. In some cases, I jump ahead.
Gravity waves have inverse cascade and all this, so they naturally would transfer something to us.
What happens with those waves, for example, if such zero frequency sideband is excited, then their finite size effects of the container may become important, and in fact this rather broadband excitation may generate some eigenstructure within the container. But that's a that's not an essential effect. I'll show you it. So if we compare how much energy is contained in each of the, so now we identify three ranges: zero frequency sideband, the exponential spectrum, and the power law spectrum. If we look at how much energy contained in each of them, at the lowest forcing, about 20% sits in the zero frequency, 82% in the exponential, and zero in the power law. As the forcing is increased, we have roughly 50-50 in their zero frequency and exponential, and 1% in the turbulent power law. And at the highest forcing, 23% is here, 50% here and 30% in the zero frequency. So we shouldn't really be throwing away this 30-50% of energy while talking about the origin of this. Okay, so we agree with some other reports from experiments that the power law is close to 17 over 6 indeed. Now, the dependence on the energy flux. If we compare the integral from 0 to 2 kilohertz, the entire spectrum, it appears to be really close to the square root of p, which is proportional to the square of delta A. Delta A is the acceleration, delta A is the acceleration above the threshold for the parametric excitation. This is measured in g squared. However, if we take just the tail, this tail, from 500 to 2 kilohertz, it appears to be a linear function. And there might be a good reason for that. Capillary waves are extremely heavily damped. The decay rate of capillary waves are proportional to k squared. So, because the turbulent power law tail appears at rather high frequencies, we are talking hundreds of hertz here, this decay rate is huge. So the whole idea of the turbulent cascade disappears because nature designed the cascade to transfer spectral energy from the spectral regions where it cannot be dissipated to the one where it can, but here it's dissipated comfortably at the location of where it gets. So there is no need for a cascade. So the questions we asked then related to this transition to the turbulence. So which mechanisms are responsible for broadening the wave spectra, broadening of the harmonics? Which mechanisms are responsible for generating the spectral continuum, which eventually will allow Grisha three wave interactions? What process randomizes wave phases, and whether the wave field is indeed detached from the boundary, whether the infinite domain is satisfied. And the answer to all of these questions, I jump ahead, is in two words, modulation and stability. Modulation and stability is a four-wave process due to cubic nonlinearity, which is responsible for all three of them. And I'll just try to illustrate how it develops. Relatively moderate forcing, and it's just the sequence of snapshots during the development of this instability. Initially, you see circular wave fronts. Waves know about the boundary, they know about the shape of the container. Later on, these wave fronts become modulated in their transverse.
This is a jump in control parameter?
Sorry?
This is a jump in control parameter. So you have some initial condition and then you just increase. What are you doing?
No, it's just time. Just time. We start shaking, and it's the natural development when we turn on the shaker.
Turn on the shaker
and just watch what's going on. But we can achieve exactly the same by just
things.
Slowly changing. Yeah. And after 0.6 of a second, no sign of any circular wavefronts. It's been detached from the wall. If we just change the forcing amplitude, at measuring the surface elevation at a single point, we observe a continuous wave, but even at very low amplitude, it's already modulated. This is the amplitude modulation. However, when the amplitude is increased, this continuous wave is broken into a series of bursts of varying widths and varying amplitudes. If we zoom in into one of them, it looks fairly symmetric and nice. So growing amplitude modulation is a signature of modulation and stability.
But is it a 2D modulation, right? It's happening in a plane.
This is happening in the plane, yes.
So it's a 2D modulation, two-dimensional.
It's two-dimensional. This is the movie of what I illustrated in the photos. However, when we measure at a single point, initially we observe that with the increase in the forcing intensity, the width of these pulses, modulation pulses, goes higher, higher, and higher. So they are violent. They are ensembles of these envelope solitons, because that's what they are, and they have precisely the same shape. It's a second hyperbolic function of time, whether we choose this this burst, or we choose this one or that one, they all have exactly the same shape.
And this is the shape of a locally one-dimensional soliton.
Well, we measure in a single point.
But in a frequency, yeah.
But this is not soliton.
It's lambda.
Yeah, soliton exists in one dimension here.
Strictly speaking, as we increase the forcing, the width of the soliton goes down from, say, 20 periods down to 7 periods, or 5. Yeah, modulation instability is known for a very long time. It's a famous Light-Hill criterion for the instability, where d omega over d a squared, a omega is the has a nonlinear correction, and this nonlinear correction for capillary wave is negative. For gravity waves, it's positive. It's a famous Stokes equation, Stokes expression for the frequency of the gravity waves. The dispersion is different. However, the product of these two, the second d omega, d squared omega dk squared, is negative. So both of them are negative. So, and both can be modulation unstable for obvious reasons. Large gravity waves attracted a lot more attention, and this was known for a long time. And usually the modulation unstable waves are described by nonlinear Schrodinger equation. This is a 1D equation in this case. And even the hyperbolic second envelope soliton was one of the historically first solutions found for the nonlinear Schrodinger equation back in 1970, and almost simultaneously modulation stability was discovered in plasma physics, modulation stability of Langmuir waves, drift waves, in nonlinear optics, and of course in the gravity surface waves, where people use Benjamin-Ferrier instability. This is an example of the modulation stability in magnetically confined plasma. This is a parent wave, which becomes modulated, and this modulation brings up what we call the zero frequency sideband. And in plasma, in toroidal plasma, it brings up the development of the zonal flow, or the mesoscale structure, which is strongly anisotropic and localized on particular radios. Okay, so how does it work? How the spectral broadening works, and what it has to do with modulation and stability? Just two examples. It's a video imaging. These are results derived from the video images. We increase the forcing at 60 hertz, and the increase in forcing, forcing increases from blue to red, and you can see this peak. This peak, in fact, is just the lab frame Doppler shift. The whole thing moves as a whole, so there is no broadening in here, just an increase in amplitude, but the harmonics are broadened. To better check and to avoid the overlapping of the harmonics, we move to substantially higher frequency. We now excite here, in this example, we excite waves at the frequency of 3.2 kilohertz, which leads to the generation of the first subharmonic 1.6, and as we increase the forcing from 3G here to 65G here, you see substantial broadening. And what's interesting, we always observe these nice exponential tails. So the spectrum in the power spectrum is very well approximated by the square of the hyper.
Fiber optic people also recently have seen this.
Yes. And it's not surprising, because the shape of the second hyperbolic in the time domain gives a second hyperbolic in the Fourier transform, and then it comes naturally. So this is modulation stability. Yes, these spectra were found in a very broad range of physical contexts. Well, probably that's not the first one. I found this back in 1978, spin waves in magnetics. More or less the same problem. They've been trying to excite waves by in magnetics, spin waves by using parametric excitation using external time-varying magnetic fields, and were very disappointed to see that as the excitation magnetic field was increased, the amplitude of the actual wave didn't increase, but instead that led to the broadening of the spin wave spectrum. Second example I bumped into was by Victor Steinberg and his collaborators back in 97, when they excited again parametrically second sound waves in the superfluid helium. from the first sound waves. First sound waves excited second sound parametrically. Again, as the parametric forcing was increased, you see a nice, beautiful broadening of the spectra and triangular spectrum. Optical fibers near the supercontinuum generation from CW pumping. Another example, supercontinuum in fibers. Again, I didn't know about this work. Apparently, they also mentioned they compared the measured spectrum blue dots with the red line, which was obtained by just putting 18 solitons, Zakharov-Shabot statistics of soliton C. So the idea was around, and as usual, people got to the same idea almost at the same time in different areas. And one more example I learned about recently, Raman fiber lasers, Babin and others, that's they increase the excitation. And they observe, again, exponential tails.
But nobody actually identified any solitons there. I mean, it's
not that easy to measure there.
Yeah, I mean,
in a single point.
I looked at their data a lot, and it's just a mess. If it's there, it's...
Well, but the spectra...
But spectra, yeah, spectra.
All right, I switched to the next topic because it appeared that the modulation and stability in capillary waves, and it has been known also in the ROG waves, are related things, and that has been realized in the oceanography.
ROG waves are not capillary waves,
right? Sorry?
ROG waves are not capillary waves.
No, ROG waves are big oceanic gravity waves, of course, and that's what captured the public and media attention because of the large number of maritime disasters that they cause. And actually, this is a snapshot from a video. You can have a look at the YouTube from last year's collision of a passenger ship with a huge ROG wave, and that was a really extreme event, and you can hear the captain swearing at the moment of the impact. This one, the oceanographers, this is a popular image you find on the web, but the oceanographers are telling me that this is the product of a Photoshop. This is not real, I don't know. But the whole area of research started. The ROG waves were considered a tailless tail until roughly 1995. And in 1995 was the first recorded ROG waves done at the Dropner oil platform in the North Sea. And this is the time record. And you see one event. The wave of whose crest was close to 20 meters hit the platform, obviously destroyed a lot on the platform, and the arguments between the oil company about the probability of such event, whether they were properly insured or underinsured or something like that, started the intense research in this area. So it's not it's a serious business whether you should put as much metal into your construction or you should consider this as a very improbable and unlikely event. So the main question with the ROG waves is the probability of these rare events. Also, the maps of and the location of the observation of such ROG waves didn't really point to any particular peculiarity in the ocean, like a current or the shape of the bottom in the ocean at that place. And of course, physicists would like to find something universal, and the idea of the modulation stability being somehow linked to the generation of ROG waves appeared. Next, an interesting development was in 2007 when something very similar was observed in optical ROG waves. And that was a paper in Nature by this group of authors. Okay, once we knew that we may expect something like that, we started looking for it, and it's not that easy to see these rare events in the capillary wave because you have to record these for a long time and with a fast camera, and then you have to watch this movie for 30, 40 minutes without blinking to see any, and you blink and you miss it. So we had to automate. We had to automate this, yeah. And after that, we found that they systematically appear in the wave field, and they look like this. This is just before this event, and this is during. This corresponds to this peak. This gray line corresponds to five times the standard deviation of the background wave field, And they are really strong events, really strong waves, and extremely steep. This strange color is due to the internal reflection of the laser light. When the laser light hits this almost vertical wavefront at almost zero angle, all the light is reflected inside.
The it's shape. Like so that
explains the discovering of this. All right, so we started looking at the statistics of it. Or maybe I'll show you how we detect them. This is a movie of what our fast camera sees. I'm not sure we have to wait for too long. We won't be doing this before we spot.
Yeah.
This is a parametric excitation, and in this case, the laser sheet we illuminated the surface wasn't too thin. It was a couple of millimeters, and that's why sometimes why is it doing this?
Transmitting from Australia, is it?
No. It has to do with the. Anyway, you get the idea how we measured it. And just to visualize what's going on at slightly higher excitation rate, you see occasionally droplets being produced by these extremely high waves. And these droplets sometimes jump 4 or 5 times, bounce off the surface.
Like in four experiments, these experiments where they have droplets bouncing and going this way.
Yeah. We see this quite often here. Why is it interesting? I mean, of course, capillary rogue waves don't present as much interest as the Big Brothers. They don't destroy anything. But recently, oceanographers told us that this process is very interesting for them as a possible mechanism of the spray generation. Parasitic capillary ripple may appear on the very steep slopes of the gravity waves, and this ripple through this mechanism may indeed start ejecting droplets upwards. And this is an important process in oceanographic literature. I've been told the spray generation rate varies between 1 and 4 orders of magnitude depending on the model and the literature. And this is one of the dominant processes responsible for the gas exchange with the atmosphere and the ocean. That's why they got interested in this. Okay, so what can we say from our experiments about the probability of these rogue waves? And we can say we can compare the probability density function. This is the wave crest amplitude expressed in mean standard deviations with a very thin spectrum at very low forcing. That's how it looks. It becomes something like exponential, I would say, at slightly higher excitation. By the way, these two peaks we mistakenly took for the classical linear stage of the modulation stability, and then we realized that this is a manifestation of precisely that effect, the generation of the eigen mode in the finite size container. It's a temporary thing, it goes away, but once we got to the stage where we generate triangular spectra, all of a sudden we observe clearly the generation of a very strong tail in the distribution function, and this tail represents the statistics of frog waves. Same generation of the tail we observed using laser transmission, so we checked, this using...
You have your tail up to what, 12 sigma?
12 sigma.
And you believe, I mean, it's really, you get that much statistic. That's unbelievable statistic, 12 sigma.
Yes. Well, nothing limits us, and we can film this for
it's only 10 to the minus 5, right?
Yeah, 10 to the minus 5, it's not, even less.
What a number.
Yeah, this is because it's so slow.
It would be 10 to the minus 20, I would be nervous, but...
So without speculating what leads to the generation of these rogue waves, there is a clear correlation between the development of modulation stability and the sudden onset of this tail in the distribution function.
But does it mean that these rogue waves can come out of the just classical NLS?
I don't know. From what we see, because we identify the triangular spectra with the envelope solitons, I can picture that somehow the probability of the superposition of the two envelope solitons increases once we have sufficient number of them. And if they collide in phase, we have a high probability of having this in high events. Our rogueways are not precisely as what is reported in the oceanographic literature. They usually have, they either have three sisters or a single event, basically three waves. We usually have more than that. We have increasing amplitude of three, four before and three, four after the maximum.
But you also got some parametric excitation.
Yes, yes. Yeah, there are differences. I'm not saying the mechanism is the same, but in this case, it's clearly correlated with the broadening of the spectrum. And
but you can do it with a larger mechanism of excitation. Use the plunger. Or...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And did you do it and check whether the probability stays the same?
Oh, it's very difficult. With the plunger, the problem is that these waves are so heavily damped. Yeah. They propagate a little bit further away from the plunger, and they don't stay. The damping stabilizes modulation instability, basically.
Yes, of course.
So this should be better done with the low frequency waves. Okay, so how do we know? Do we have any evidence that we are dealing with modulation stability, which is a four-wave process, as I said? There is another useful characteristic, which measures the degree of the four-wave coupling now, which is called tricoherence, and it looks like this. Again, same as the bicoherence, for the coherent phase, four-wave interaction equals to one, and it's zero for the random phase. Mm-hmm. When we increase forcing, this is the maximum. It's hard to represent because we need three frequencies plus amplitude on the plot, and it's tricky to visualize it properly. So we prefer just plotting the maximum tricoherence, the maximum point we found in the data set as a function of the supercriticality or the forcing. As we exceed, this is the moment where we start observing their triangular spectra, modulational instability strongly developing, and the maximum tricoherence jumps above 0.5. I must say, later on we found that as the forcing goes further, increases further, the tricoherence goes down. But this doesn't correspond, has at least two explanations. Either four-wave interactions stop becoming the dominant process because three-wave process kicks in, or wave phases become random. This is a parameter which is sensitive to coherent phase coupling. Okay, so how these wave phases in three-wave interactions become random, and what does it mean, random? Again, we looked at into the spectrum, and we get back to this crossover frequency where the power law meets their exponential. What happens at this frequency? From the spectral point of view, nothing, because we have discrete harmonics before and after, and these harmonics are now sitting on the sum continuum background. However, if we take this frequency, we can figure out a very simple empirical law. The strongest wave in the system is, of course, this one, with a period T1. And at this frequency, wave becomes substantially modulated, as I explained. If we take the statistically average width of the soliton and compare it with the period of the first harmonic, the condition, T1 over tau appears to be less than 1 at this point, at the crossover frequency. And this is visualized here, this is experimental traces of the waves. So the statistically averaged width of the envelope soliton becomes shorter than the period of the first harmonic. And sharply from that, bicoherence goes down.
T1
is the frequency of this. This is the mother of them all.
This is what you drive.
Okay. Yes.
Now, what is tau? It's the length of your...
All these waves are modulated now. These waves are modulated, and the higher the frequency, the shorter the lifetime of this envelope soliton. In seconds.
Yeah. You made me completely confused. I mean, it's, when you show me the soliton, you did not filter it to see, or you filter it at this particular wave, because this soliton is not a
plane wave. Yeah, I zoom into this.
So you took a piece of your spectrum and you filter it out, and then you see the soliton. Ah, okay. And then depending on whether you filter it out, you have different bits of soliton.
Yes.
Right.
But if you look at this picture, you understand what I mean. This is the period of the first harmonic, and the first harmonic interacts with this soliton, and it interacts far more efficiently if the length or the width of this soliton is larger than the period. When it becomes smaller than the period, that's it. That marks the transition from the coherent phase interaction to the random phase interaction. And surprise, surprise, it correlates precisely with this frequency FCO, which marks the transition from the power law to the exponential spectrum. All right. And the final remark I would like to make is the effect of the finite container size. I showed this already, and it's clear that the wave field forgets about the shape of the container and forgets about the boundary. We measured the autocorrelation function at a single point in space somewhere, and for three different levels of forcing, 1, 2, 3, and you can see as the forcing goes up, the autocorrelation function decreases such that it's below 0.3 after two periods of oscillation at this level of forcing already. And this is not a new result. Something like that has been done quite a long time ago by Tufillaro, Ramsankar, and Golub back in 1988, where they measured the spatial correlation function, shown here, as a function of drive. And there is a sharp decrease in the correlation length as the forcing is increased. Basically, when the correlation length becomes shorter than the radius of the container, waves forget about the distance, and the whole wave field becomes detached. In fact, we have checked this by increasing slightly by a factor of 2 the size of the container, and also by decreasing significantly by a factor of 50 the wavelength by increasing the excitation frequency. And we convinced ourselves that the results are not dependent on the size or on the shape of the container for intermediate and high forcing levels. All right, so the conclusions. We found that modulation and stability exists in capillary waves, surprisingly, but that for whatever reason has not been reported before, that the modulation and stability is responsible for breaking continuous waves into envelope solitons, and it leads to the spectral broadening of the wave harmonics and the formation of the second hyperbolic spectra. Modulation stability development is correlated with the increased probability of the generation of anomalous wave events or capillary rogue waves. The same instability is responsible for the order to disorder transition and the detachment of the wave field from the container. And it's responsible for the phase randomization in three-wave interactions. In other words, the modulation stability or the four-wave process due to the cubic nonlinearity provides all the prerequisites for the weak turbulence theory then to start working, and which is the three-wave interactions and which is the quadratic nonlinearity. Thank you.
Questions, remarks? I just want to remark that it's, we kind of knew it since 70s when did all the spin wave parametric excitation. The parametric wave is a very bad way to exert turbulence because the wave excitation is phase sensitive. So pumping is always in phase with this pairs of waves which it exerts, so it creates a state of waves which has a very, very well-defined phases. And then to have something which is with the wave turbulence, you need somehow to randomize these phases. And this is usually requires a very high amplitude and more or less goes to kind of like we've shown on your channel, stability. It'd be very interesting to know how your tail or frog
I agree, but you by doing this random forcing, you conceal all the physics behind. That's why I think was a confusion.
Cause yes.
Basically, by randomizing it, you're doing the work which is done by the modulation stability. Yeah. You spectrally broaden all the harmonics, and then you generate the continuum.
Now, if somebody would ask me how it actually goes in capillary waves before your experiments, I would not answer. I did not know but on the other hand, you quoted the data, experimental data of Milkov, and I don't know, like 25 years ago, Milkov asked me, what I need to do in my spin wave system to see your weak turbulence spectra? And I said, drop the parametric excitation, and you'll never see them as parametric excitation.
How else?
But then again, how else to exaggerate? Yeah.
We tried three different techniques. We tried the plunger, we tried the wave maker, we tried the shaker. The spectra are identical. They're no different. So it's more control when you just shake and you say K naught equals to zero and the mega is fixed and so on. But I don't think the physics is different than any other.
Basically, what they tried back then in Kiev, they made two pumpings. The one was parametrical pumping, and then they added another. And then they saw that maybe that would somehow make phases different. But the interplay between these two stations was so complicated that eventually there was a whole new field.